Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you full coverage of Benedict XVI's apostolic journey to Cyprus, his 16th abroad and his first to a majority Orthodox country. A landmark visit, given it's the first time in history a Roman pontiff lands on the shores of this small island floating in the Mediterranean Sea. At a crossroads between East and West, Cyprus recently joined the European Union, and earlier still in modern history was, since 1974, marked by a partition, with the northern third inhabited by Turkish Cypriots and southern two-thirds by Greek Cypriots, a green line patrolled by United Nations dividing the two parts. Going back to more ancient times, the island was always a meeting place of Eastern Mediterranean civilizations, often battlefield of races, languages, faiths and civilizations at the dawn of history. It's where mythology merged into history, and where the cultures, arts and languages of the three great civilizations of the Greeks, the Phoenicians and the Egyptians flourished. For centuries, the Temple of Aphrodite in Paphos, in the southwest part of the island, was the most celebrated shrine of that goddess in the ancient world. But more interestingly to us, Paphos, with its biblical heritage, is where Benedict XVI begins his visit to Cyprus, following in the footsteps of St. Paul and St. Barnabas, in the very place where almost 2,000 years ago they once landed and preached. Charles Collins is in Cyprus and reports on the Holy Father's arrival there on Friday, 4th of June.
Paphos is one of the most historic sites in Cyprus. It was considered the birthplace of the Greek goddess Athena and served as a religious center in the Mediterranean for centuries. Saint Paul visited Cyprus on his first missionary journey, traversing the entire island. It was at Paphos that he converted the Roman proconsul, Sergius Paulus, to Christianity. St. Paul's visit to the island is one of the chief reasons Pope Benedict is visiting Cyprus, as he announced upon his arrival.
Following the footsteps of our common fathers in the faith, Saints Paul and Barnabas, I've come among you as a pilgrim. Since the apostles brought the Christian message to these shores, Cyprus has been blessed by a resilient Christian heritage.
The president of Cyprus, Dimitrios Christofias, welcomed the Pope, saying his presence conveys a strong message of peace over hatred and war.
Η παρουσία σας εδώ μεταφέρει ηχηρό μήνυμα υπέρ της επικράτησης της ειρήνης έναντι του μίσους και του πολέμου.
He said Cyprus needs the Pope's words of peace.
Η Κύπρος έχει ανάγκη από τον ειρηνικό σας λόγο.
Given the difficult situation the island is facing in its Turkish occupied area. The president also drew attention to the destruction and looting of Christian sites in northern Cyprus since the 1974 Turkish invasion. Pope went from the airport to the church Hagia Kyriaki, the site where St. Paul was said to have been scourged at a pillar. The church sits among the ruins of a much larger basilica, which was destroyed by marauding Arabs in the 7th century. The church serves both the local Catholic and Anglican communities in the vastly Orthodox city, so it was a fitting place for Pope Benedict to attend an ecumenical service, hosted by the Orthodox Bishop of Paphos, Metropolitan Georgios. After arriving, Pope Benedict knelt for prayer in front of the icons which cover the sanctuary of the church, before going outside where the people were gathered among the archaeological ruins. On his way out of the church, he met and blessed a 10-year-old Sri Lankan girl, Jasmita Maharaja Singh. The child survived brain cancer and heart surgery, and her story has captured the heart of the Cypriot people, who named her the Angel of Cyprus. Outside of the church, the Pope was welcomed by a choir and the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, since Cyprus is considered part of the Holy Land. Joining the Pope were several Orthodox bishops, as well as representatives of the Armenian, Lutheran, and Anglican communions.
Today we can be grateful to the Lord, who through His Spirit has led us, especially in these last decades, to rediscover the rich apostolic heritage shared by East and West, and in patient and sincere dialogue to find ways of drawing closer to one another, overcoming past controversies, and looking to a better future. The Church in Cyprus, which serves as a bridge between East and West, has contributed much to this process of reconciliation. The path leading to the goal of full communion will certainly not be without its difficulties. Yet the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church of Cyprus are committed to advancing in the way of dialogue and fraternal cooperation.
Pope Benedict concluded his remarks by speaking about the importance of holiness in the Christian life.
Conversion and holiness are also the privileged means by which we open our minds and hearts to the Lord's will for the unity of His Church.
After the ecumenical meeting, Pope Benedict left Paphos by car for the nearly two-hour drive from the coast to the interior of the island and the capital, Nicosia. The Holy Father is staying in the Apostolic Nunciature, located in the UN-controlled buffer zone. Within sight of the gate to the monastery, which houses the Nunciature, are sandbags and abandoned gun positions. It's a stark reminder of the suffering the nation has endured over the past 35 years. With the Pope in Nicosia, I'm Charles Collins.
Earlier in the day, while on his flight over to Cyprus, the Holy Father spoke to members of the press accompanying him on this journey. Vatican spokesperson, Jesuit Father Federico Lombardi, commented for us in Italian on the Pope's words. I've asked Chris Altieri to read an English version of this comment for us.
A journey marked by ecclesial communion, ecumenical dialogue, and patient efforts towards peace. These are the aspects of this visit to Cyprus that the Pope highlighted as he spoke to journalists on his flight toward the island. The Synod of Bishops for the Middle East, scheduled for October, will be a great opportunity for us to encounter and get to know each other better, and therefore for mutual comfort, mutual research for ways to witness, as large and small, minority communities of different rites and traditions. For Catholics, therefore, a message of communion and encouragement, an invitation not to look inwards, but to become more capable of witness and service, readier to give visibility to the wealth of the millennium, old Christian presence in lands where the seed for our faith was sown. The encounter with members of the Orthodox Church will be marked by steps forward on a path full of promise, so that our common witness, the Christian vision of man and life, emerges more strongly than ever in today's world, where fundamental values are not only challenged, but often radically contested. Theological differences mustn't allow us to forget that unifying factors are much more important than those that still divide. Finally, the patient efforts to announce peace despite situations and episodes which provoke anxiety and discouragement. The spiritual and religious mission of the Pope continues in the same spirit as his last year's journey to the Holy Land. The gospel remains an inexhaustible source of hope to break down the barriers of the deepest of divisions.
And now I'd like to step back in time for a moment, just to recall how Benedict XVI declared from the beginning of his pontificate how he'd make it a priority as Peter's current successor to take on as his primary task the duty to work tirelessly to rebuild the full and visible unity of all Christ's followers. A goal he shares with the head of the Orthodox Church in Cyprus, His Beatitude Chrysostomus II. One, His Beatitude communicated to the Pope when he formally invited him to Cyprus during their meeting in the Vatican on the 16th of June 2007, reiterating a previous invitation on behalf of the President of Cyprus himself. Why not listen back to that invitation delivered in Greek, as well as an English version of his words read for us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Σας θέλουμε κοντά μας. Δημών ο Απόστολος Βαρνάβας.
We want you beside us. Through us, the Holy Apostle Barnabas invites his elder brother, the Blessed Apostle Peter, to make a first visit to his humble home and to receive hospitality in it, to feel as though it were his own home and to bless it. We await you, Your Holiness, as Bishop of the Roman See, which presides in charity in the Cyprus of dialogue, democracy, dignity, faith, monasticism, hospitality, monuments, and works of art. May you deign to come to us and give us the opportunity to reciprocate your fraternal hospitality during these splendid days that we have spent in the Eternal City.
An invitation this on the part of the head of the Orthodox Church in Cyprus, His Beatitude Chrysostomus II, which Charles Collins mentions in the next report, one he filed upon his arrival in Cyprus, giving us an overview of this journey, beginning by highlighting one of the reasons the Holy Father is in Cyprus. A moment this to look forward to on Sunday, the final day of the Holy Father's visit, when he's scheduled to present the working document of the Special Synod of Bishops for the Middle East, which will take place at the Vatican in October. But let's listen to Charles' reporting.
Cyprus may seem an odd choice to launch the Instrumentum Laboris, a working document of the Middle East meeting of the Synod of Bishops. The country is in the European Union, uses the euro as its currency, and speaks Greek. In fact, one of the books given to journalists by the government is about how European Cyprus really is. But when you look at a map, Cyprus's proximity to the Middle East is obvious. Tucked near the underbelly of Turkey, it's just a short flight or boat ride away from Lebanon, Israel, and Syria. Look at its history. It was part of the Eastern Roman Empire and served as a stopover for the Crusaders. It came under Ottoman rule before being handed over to the British in 1878. Similar stories could be told about Lebanon, Palestine, Egypt. Even demographically, Cyprus, with its mixture of Christians and Muslims, looks as much of the Middle East did just a century ago. Over the past 100 years, the Christian presence in the Middle East has declined sharply. There were 2 million Christians in Turkey in 1920. Now there are a few thousand. The Holy Land was once at least a third Christian. Now it's just a few percent. In Lebanon, Christians were over half of the population 60 years ago. Now they're about a third. Similar stories can be told in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and other countries covered by the Synod. Cyprus, too, has not been unaffected. In Paphos, the Orthodox Church is omnipresent. Its churches dot the skyline. After an ecumenical service, the Pope will travel to the capital, Nicosia, and go to the Apostolic Nunciature, which is in the middle of the UN-controlled buffer zone. A UN barracks overlooks the monastery which holds the Nunciature. Just a short walk away is the Turkish-occupied part of Cyprus. After the Turkish invasion in 1974, almost all the Christians in northern Cyprus were forced from their homes. The churches in the region have been vandalized and priceless works of art looted. On Sunday, after celebrating the Mass publishing the Instrumentum Laboris, the Pope will visit the Maronite Cathedral in Nicosia. The majority of Catholics in Cyprus are Maronite, and the majority of them are refugees from the north. So Cyprus, too, is affected by the problems hitting the church in the Middle East. For the people of Cyprus, the idea that they are in the Middle East is not one they embrace. For them, the trip is about ecumenism, the first visit of Pope Benedict to an Orthodox country, and the first visit by any pope to Cyprus. The invitation to Cyprus also came from the Orthodox Archbishop, Chrysostomus II, and given the fact that many Orthodox churches in the country have images of Catholic clergy falling into the inferno, this is a major step forward in relations. They also want to bring attention to the Turkish occupation of a third of their country, and are waiting for what the Pope will say when he meets the diplomatic corps and United Nations personnel on Saturday.
As we know, Cyprus is part of the canonical territory of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and the Patriarch himself, Fouad Toile, will be among the key players at the forthcoming synod. He's among those with Pope Benedict XVI in Cyprus at the moment. Charles Collins caught up with him there.
Well, we are very pleased to see the Holy Father come back to the Holy Land. We have to remember that Cyprus is a part of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and we are here for this. He is again with us in the Holy Land. And as you know, the situation is still the same, despite all the calls of the Father, despite our prayers, despite the goodwill of many, many people, the situation of conflict is still there. And here we are just on the border between this. We are already acquainted with walls. And you can see the walls everywhere here, as well as in Jerusalem. The most important meaning of this visit, you have to remember, the first theme of the Instrumentum Laboris of the Lineamenta was the communion. I think this must be the point on which we have to underline the communion between, first of all, between us Catholic with our many good rites. They are a richness, but I hope that they stay richness, not a cause of division. And then the communion with the other church, with the Orthodox Church. We are happy to know this very good relation between the Greek Cypriot Church and the Catholic Church. We have good collaboration through our institutions, through the Caritas, through the schools in a special way. And you will see that how they will receive very well the Pope, whether the civil authorities or the Cypriot Church. For sure they will be an encouragement for us to stay, for Christians to stay, to collaborate, to be aware of our identity as Christians in this Middle East.
And that identity is attached to this, the physicality of the places.
Identity, which means we must know that we are here before any other religion, before the Islams came. We are the people of this, of the Holy Land. Identity as citizens and as Christians, we are not refugees. Though our situation is bad, difficult, but in the same time, I can say we have many good things, many good signs, thanks God. We have many, many pilgrims coming to see us, to pray with us, to pray for us, thanks God. We have good solidarity from all the Catholic world, even not Catholic, solidarity to the Holy Land, to the institutions, to the church. We have in the same time seminaries packed from seminarians. It is not everything is dramatic. We must be even optimistic, despite the dramatic situation. We must be optimistic, must be courageous, relying not on the political situation, relying on the words of the Lord who said, "Don't be afraid, I am with you." And if he is with us, we must be courageous and go on without any fear.
The countries that are covered by the Middle East Synod, Cyprus is right now the only one that is still majority Christian. Yet if we look back, 100, 200, 300 years, the rest of the Middle East was that. Is there a fear of this loss of the Christian presence in the Holy Land? Is how big a theme is this going to be during the Synod?
Well, really, we have two dramas in the Holy Land. First of all, the lack of peace. And the second, the emigration of our Christians. And we have to remember that those who leave are those who have more culture, more diplomas, and the young people. That's the fact with the schools. When they finish the university, the schools, and they cannot find any work. Everything is closed. The walls are closed. I do understand that the first option that they have is to leave, looking for something better outside. They know it is a problem, big problem for us. They must be aware that the fact to be in the Holy Land is a mission, and any mission means sacrifices, means a cross. They must be aware of this spiritual dimension of our presence. Second, we leaders and the government and Israel and the international community, we must give them more hope that one day peace can come, justice can come, and they can have just normal life. What we are looking for them and for us and for our priests and nuns, just normal life. We don't want privilege. Till now we have in this normal life.
You were listening there to the head of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, Fuad Twal. Finally, given the first main event of Benedict XVI's apostolic journey to Cyprus began in Paphos, the very place where the apostles Paul and Barnabas once preached, as recounted in the Acts of the Apostles, I'd like to bring you the story of Barnabas, this well-to-do Jew from this Mediterranean island, so often mentioned in the Acts, and according to the scripture scholar, we're about to listen to a giant figure from our family tree of faith. Let's listen then to Australian Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn.
Today I want to introduce you to a well-to-do Jew who this time comes from the diaspora, from outside Palestine, that is. This particular man, one of our forebears in faith, came from Cyprus, and his name was Joseph. But again, like Peter, he's much better known to us by his nickname, Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. Now, this gives us a first glimpse into the personality of this fascinating character. He must have been one of those encouraging types of people. You know what I mean? There are some people who are just like that. Hence the nickname that he gets in history, Barnabas. Now, I find him a particularly fascinating figure because when you read the New Testament, it's almost as if he gets deliberately written out. We are talking about one of the giants of early Christianity, the early church. But more and more as you read on through the New Testament, you're left wondering what happened to Barnabas. He just plummets off into a black hole, and he isn't big news these days. I mean, when is St. Barnabas's feast? Good question. Can you answer it off the top of your head? And in the whole of Rome, certainly in the Centro Storico, there is not a single church, incredibly, dedicated to Barnabas. So not only does he get written out of the Bible, it's almost as if he gets written out of the city of Rome. So what happened to Barnabas? Joseph from Cyprus. He came to Jerusalem eventually and became a Christian. Not only did he become a Christian, but he became a highly respected member of the Jerusalem community. In part, this was because he had a block of land somewhere which he sold and he gave the proceeds to the apostles in Jerusalem. That's always an extremely good way to become a respected member of the community. But there were many other reasons as well. Let me explain to you why he's one of the giants of primitive Christianity, the early church. First of all, it was Barnabas who bit the bullet and introduced Paul to the Jerusalem church. Now consider, Paul was the great persecutor of Christianity. Therefore, when he appears on the scene preaching the gospel, he was a figure treated with the greatest of suspicion, and many of the people in Jerusalem were saying, "Don't trust him." Well, it was Barnabas who took Paul by the hand and introduced him to the apostles and to the community in Jerusalem in one of the most fateful introductions in human history, not just in the life of the church. Secondly, when they began to preach the gospel to Gentiles in Antioch, up in Jerusalem, a lot of red lights, or at least amber lights, began to flash, and people were saying, stop it, the gospel is only for Jews. You can't preach to Gentiles. At this point of enormous controversy, the Jerusalem church, the mother church, chose Barnabas to go down to Antioch to make the crucial discernment, was this of God or not? So Barnabas goes down, he sees what's happening, agrees it's extraordinary, but he makes the crucial discernment for the whole of history that this is of God. The gospel is for everyone, not just for Jews. But he makes a second crucial discernment because he knows that in this volatile scene in Antioch, he needs the right kind of leadership team. So therefore, the question of recruitment becomes crucial. Who do we recruit? Who do we need in the leadership team in this church in Antioch? And suddenly the penny drops late one night and he thinks, Paul. Paul has gone back to Tarsus, has been there for some years. Barnabas goes to Tarsus, puts it to Paul and brings Paul back to Antioch. So it's Barnabas who not only introduces Paul to the Jerusalem community in the first place, but who brings him back onto the stage of history and makes him the great apostle that he becomes. When the church in Antioch decides that it's time for mission outside Palestine, the man they choose to lead the first ever Christian mission outside Palestine is Barnabas, not Paul. Paul is the vice captain, as it were. So the first ever Christian mission outside Palestine is a Barnabite mission. Now, when there is the great brawl in Antioch, this disagreement about Jewish and Gentile Christians, how they should relate to each other, Barnabas agreed with Peter and disagreed with Paul. So at that point, you get a great split between these two great friends and allies. Paul goes his way and Barnabas goes his. Two missionary teams. Barnabas, we are told, takes with him John Mark, whom he had on the first ever Christian mission outside Palestine, and he returns to his native Cyprus to confirm the missionary work that he, Paul, and John Mark had done in the first place. At that point, he gets written out. What happened to him? There's a tradition that, in fact, he was martyred eventually in Cyprus, but in the end, we don't know. So there you have it, a man and one of the giants of the early church who seemed so triumphantly a winner at the start, but who in the end seems a kind of loser as he goes off into the black hole of history and to a kind of anonymity. When's his feast? Hard to know. Why no church in Rome? Hard to know. But what is easy to know is that every one of us, deep down, bear his spiritual genes. In other words, we're all Barnabites, all of us sons of the Son of Encouragement.
You were listening there to scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Be sure to tune in at the same time tomorrow for further coverage of Pope Benedict XVI's busy day in the capital of Cyprus, Nicosia. Laudetur Jesus Christus.